It's time for another episode of the Infinite Loopback Podcast, an Apple-themed technology podcast with your hosts, Brian Baggett, Jim Graham, Brad Tarver, and Jason Young. All right, let's go ahead and get started with some follow-up. Just jump right into things. So there's a couple of things. First, I have an announcement to make. It's called I Have No Willpower is what it's called. So you guys know where this is going.
I'm pretty sure I called that on last week's episode, did I not?
Yeah.
You went and found some change in the corner, didn't you?
Well, you know, thanks to those tax cuts that just went in, I noticed that I had enough extra scratch that I could actually pick up a HomePod. So yeah, I went ahead and ordered a HomePod. I'm terrible. You know, it's late at night. You have the Apple Store app open. You're looking at it. Your finger's hovering over the button. Next thing you know, you got a HomePod on the way.
Saying to yourself, I need this. I need it.
Well, I got a complete set. I have the Google one, the Amazon one, and now, you know, we're going for the hat trick. So that should surprise no one, I think, honestly.
Yeah, it surprises no one. So what's your ship date? I mean, how are those starting to slip, or are they still about the same?
No, they're you can get them on launch day. So I actually ordered it the night of February 1st. You know, when Jason said on Telegram the other day, he said, my credit card charged. I knew when I ordered it on February 1st, as soon as I hit the pre-order, it hit the credit card immediately. So I'm like, yeah, they're getting ready to ship now. So because normally when you pre-order, like when you do an iPhone, it's whenever it begins to ship is when you get the credit card charge. I hit the button and it charged immediately. So I at least had enough gumption to go through my credit card's portal. So I got double points for ordering it. So that was another impetus of, let's go ahead and do this then.
I love doing that.
Justifiable logic, right? How could you not pass that deal up?
Exactly, right? I mean, it's craziness. So I'll be joining you on February 9th. And I do have some stuff to talk about, too, in regards to HomePod that at least there's something I think Jim may find interesting. So we'll get to that in just a minute. But something else in the terms of follow-up from last week. So we were talking about last week about how Bonjour sucks, Jason says. That's his premise. And I don't entirely disagree because it is sometimes flaky. There is a way, and I said last week I would find it, there is a way to make Bonjour work over VPN. Now, I have not implemented it yet, but I did locate the article that identifies how to do this. And basically, it comes down to name resolution. If you're running your own name server internally, you can append the name of your printer with something like .local and make that make your VPN hand out that DNS. So when the DNS lookups happen, it'll find your printer. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's not worth going into right now, but there is a way to make it work.
It is the least Apple-y solution ever.
Oh, I totally agree.
Who besides geeks like us are going to install their own DNS server at home, configure just your VPN product to use that DNS just to be able to publish a printer over AirPrint that you should be able to print to if you're on the same network to begin with?
That was the first thing I did right out of the gate.
And who prints anymore anyway?
Parents print a lot, and that should tell you something. Sometimes my wife does, like with coupons and whatnot. If she wants to do that, she'll print something. But ever since they had boarding passes on your Apple Watch, I've not needed to print anything in forever.
I can't believe you're that guy. I mean, I use the boarding pass on my phone, but at least not my watch.
Why not? Why not use it on your watch? What's the problem?
I don't know. It just seems like the phone is enough. Like the watch, you're just pushing it too far for it not to work one day and hold up everybody else in line.
I've done that. Oh, I've done that. But you'll be happy to know that I do keep a copy. So when I do my check-in, when I fly, I get a printed copy of the boarding pass that I have in my other hand, in my right hand. So if I'm trying to make my watch, if it doesn't scan after one or two times, it's immediately out with a printed pass. Boom, get on the plane. I'll tell you something that I've learned using a boarding pass with your watch that's annoying, but it's been fixed. What's the one thing that will make your watch turn off? It's taking it and turning it upside down. That orientation will turn the lock the display, and it's a very annoying maneuver. The Delta app I've noticed, or maybe it's the wallet app or whatever the boarding, wherever the boarding pass resides, it doesn't do that anymore. So if I put my Delta pass on my watch, it doesn't turn it off when I flip my wrist over. The thing that you'll find that's annoying is that sometimes when you fly, it's been my experience most of the time with Delta, they'll have the little scanners that are flat and you just turn your wrist over and put it on there and you're good. Sometimes you'll be flying and they'll have a scanner and it has like this, it's a top-down scanner, but that only leaves about an inch between the place where you put it and your boarding pass. So there's no human wrist that could fit under there. So sometimes I'm not able to use it, but it depends, you know. And
on Southwest, they use that type of scanner top down, and it's just kind of hanging there. It looks almost like an old QCAT hanging there, and you just swipe underneath it. So you just kind of hold your phone up underneath it. So that seems to work fine. They don't have the turn it over ever. So
the other trick that you can use, and I'm going to show you guys on the screen, is this. where you put your watch face down on your wrist.
Or you could just put it on your phone and not try to use your watch.
I own a watch. The watch needs to get some use. Actually, that is a really cool thing to be able to do it. I wish they would all just move to like NFC or something like that. It would be much better and they wouldn't have to rely on this primitive scanning technology that's way out of date.
Yeah, with Southwest, you end up with the little QR code on your phone.
Same with Delta.
All right.
All right, so the good stuff now. So tell us about your iMac Pro that you got this week. It arrived this week. You got on the deal that Micro Center had where they have it $1,000 off, which is still in effect, I noticed. This morning, I went to the website. It's like, is this still going on? It's like, it is. I'm like, Brian, you don't need that. You don't need an iMac Pro. Stop it. So I did not get one. But it is still, that deal is still in effect, and it looks great. So how are you enjoying yours?
Yeah, man, you guys are not healthy for my back pocket. Since I've joined this podcast, I've probably purchased more current Apple technology than I had in previous years. So the thing is absolutely great. I kind of think of the group of us podcasters as enablers are us. According to my receipt from Amazon and the countdown from Wolfram Alpha, it has been 3,163 days since I last purchased a new Mac. And that was a 2009 Mac Pro that people have heard me talk about over the last few months of being on the show. Loved that machine, 24-inch Apple Cinema display. It was an 8-core. It was the greatest of its day back then. And over the years, I've added RAM and solid state. But recently, I tried to upgrade VMware Fusion, and I couldn't because I got an error message that my processor architecture was no longer supported. So that wasn't necessarily my direct impetus. Like that wasn't a deal breaker where I needed to go out immediately and buy a new machine. But you guys had kind of sent around the notice on Telegram, like, holy crap, the iMac Pro is $1,000 off at Micro Center. So I hemmed and hawed about it, and last Sunday morning I decided I was going to go drive to Micro Center and pick one up. Got up, loaded the Micro Center page, and it was back up to $42.99. I was like, you know what, that's my sign. Just don't need one now that I know that I could have had it for $4,000, but it's $4,300 now. I'm just gonna pass. And then the very next day, Brian sends me a message. He's like, hey, it's back down to $4,000 again. So what I ended up doing, I am a Best Buy Elite Plus member, and I called up their main line and asked if they would do a price match to Micro Center, which they did. So I was able to get 12 months same as cash on the deal, score a bunch of Best Buy points, and this thing is super smoking fast. I cannot emphasize how crazy fast this machine is. I guess the biggest thing for me that I've noticed so far, because I haven't really tried to do any kind of major tests on it, is disk access speed is just phenomenal.
Well, you have an SSD now. You didn't have one in your 2009 Mac Pro, did you?
I sure did. I upgraded it several years back, but it was on a SATA 2 bus. It was a really nice SSD that I had in there, but like my max speed was 280 megabytes a second to say 300 megabytes a second transfer time. And when I ran the Blackmagic disk tester app on the iMac Pro, I'm getting 3000 megabytes per second. So 3 gigabytes per second transfer speed on this thing is just absolutely nuts. But going from a 24-inch non-retina display to a 27-inch 5K 3P color gamut, I literally went from like a Yugo to the top of the line Bentley. I'm extremely enamored with this machine right now.
That is great. So you've noticed a definite speed increase. Is it like using a brand new machine?
When your normal, or what you know is normal, is slow, and you step into such an upgrade, it just kind of like things install times. The other day I installed TurboTax. Well, I mean, TurboTax never took long, but it took 3 or 4 minutes. And this thing took like 20 to 30 seconds and was done. And I know our listeners have kind of heard me harp in the past over how much I love those Klipsch-powered monitors. But since I got such an awesome machine, I ended up adding a pair of Klipsch-powered monitors to be the speakers for the iMac Pro. And then threw in a Mirage 12-inch subwoofer that I had in the basement from an old sound system. So this machine is the setup on the desk. I bought one of the 12 South high-rise Pro stands that has internal storage built in, but it elevates the screen a little bit.
So you had to accessorize.
Well, yeah.
You are so like me, it's not even funny.
I think it was 9to5Mac had a article a couple weeks back that if you didn't get a Magic Trackpad 2 in Space Gray, how you could go about getting one, and I followed that to a T. You actually have to contact Apple support, tell them that you purchased an iMac Pro from someone that wasn't Apple but an authorized dealer. They'll ask you for your serial number, and what they do is they actually write up a support ticket and prescribe the replacement part as being a Space Gray Magic Trackpad 2. So on my receipt that I got back from talking to Apple support, like the subject was damaged power cord or something, and the fix for that was a Space Gray Magic Trackpad 2.
Lies, all lies.
Yeah.
So they do have them, and they can send them out individually.
But only if you own an iMac Pro and can prove it.
You need to find somebody's serial number and just get one.
So all that came in the box was a gray keyboard and a gray mouse.
Yes, sir. It was funny, the day after I bought it, I had a buddy who likes Apple equipment, who's a coworker. I sent him a message, and it just said, "Hey, man, I got a black lightning cable." And he wrote back, and he said, "So?" And I said, "Dude, I got a black lightning cable." And about 5 minutes later, it hit him. He wrote me back. He was like, "You got an Apple black lightning cable?" I was like, "Yeah." He said, "Did it come with an iMac Pro attached?" Sure did.
And the coolest thing that you're not even mentioning was the black Apple stickers that you had in the box instead of the white ones that normally come with it.
Ooh, cool.
Damn, that's pretty sharp.
I'm going to have to find those then, because I think I was so excited to get the machine that I didn't go through any of the swag that came with it.
I only saw it through the iJustine unboxing video of her iMac Pro that she had the black Apple stickers, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. So let's see. With HomePod arriving this Friday, there's some things that we should probably talk about. It's reported that the version of Siri that comes with HomePod is going to have some big limitations, and I find that very, very distressing. So one of the things that you're not able to do is ask it obscure questions. So it says it can handle general knowledge type questions, like how many feet are in a meter or something like that. But if you ask it something about a celebrity or an athlete or something silly, it won't answer. And that's kind of strange, because I was watching a movie with my wife on the Apple TV. I invoked Siri on the Apple TV and I said, "How old is Bruce Willis?" And it's like, "Sorry, I can't tell you that." But then I can pick up my phone and ask the same question and it would come back with how old he was. So this type of stuff is really silly. I know that they specialize, like the version of Siri on the Apple TV can find movies and do things, and that, you know, presumably the iOS version can't. But I mean, come on, some of this stuff, you have a Siri-only interface. It has to work great on the one that has the Siri-only interface. So it also says that, you know, it can check your calendar. I mean, it can access your calendar to see if you have any appointments coming up, which I find weird. And to make a call, you're going to supposedly have to dial it on your phone first and select the HomePod as a speaker, kind of like you would your Mac or anything else. I don't know. That seems weird to me. So I guess when we get it, we'll be able to bear that out. But this is what I'm hearing.
That's some BS right there. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, if they're going to make this a smart speaker, then it needs to be as smart as Siri is on my phone or iPad or anywhere else.
Yes, this shouldn't be a challenge, because they've already solved this problem on so many other devices.
Is it a processing power question? It's all in the cloud. Like, you ask it, and it's not like it's trying to figure that stuff out. It sends it off somewhere, right?
Well, famously, most of the time, they do their processing on device, but it's an A8. It's not having to power a display. You would think that this computationally, it wouldn't be that intensive for it to do. I don't know. We'll see when we get it, and hopefully, if this is something that's a limitation, maybe they'll fix it in 11.3. Who knows? But that just seems insane to me. The other thing that seems really insane to me is that Apple has listed all the ways that you can play audio on the HomePod, and Bluetooth is not one of them. And that is really, really weird, considering that it has Bluetooth in it. And you have to have an iOS device to be able to set up the device. So if you're an Apple Music user on Android, which presumably there are some, I guess you're out of luck. And I just don't understand this. It seems really strange why you wouldn't, since you already have the technology in the device and you use it, it's so ubiquitous everywhere else, why only depend on AirPlay? I can see not being able to do things like, you know, multi-device stuff with it, I guess. I think that's in Bluetooth 5.0, though, being able to stream to multiple devices. But wow, I mean, that's really, you're not supporting Bluetooth in this thing?
Well, you can't even stream multiple devices to it yet, right? Not until AirPlay 2, and they said that's not ready yet, right?
That's correct, but I'm saying that if it has Bluetooth 5.0, which is what I'm hearing it does, Bluetooth 5.0, I believe that spec supports being able to stream to multiple devices from a single device. I think if I know at least one device that has Bluetooth 5, and I think that's one of the features that it's supposed to have. But regardless, even if you didn't even have that functionality, just being able to select it as a Bluetooth speaker and stream stuff to it, you would think you'd be able to do. I mean, it's such a basic thing that I can't understand why it's not there.
I think it's because they're trying to keep you, at least initially, locked into the Apple ecosystem. I think they are releasing this first version almost as a, well, what's the word I'm looking for?
Beta?
Definitely a beta. Kind of a exclusive to current Apple customers to kind of vet that out. The Sonos, it doesn't come with Bluetooth either. So that was kind of one of my biggest gripes and one of the reasons why I would never take a Sonos device with me on vacation was Sonos required a Wi-Fi network or a hardwired network, and the app had to, you know, communicate on the same network with that. My Yamaha Music Cast, the WX-030 Gem, you like those funny model numbers. Now that one is AirPlay compatible, it's Music Cast compatible, and it's Bluetooth compatible. So last year when Kate and I went on a anniversary vacation, we had a lake house that we knew was going to kind of be out in the middle of nowhere. Didn't know if coverage was going to be spotty or not. So it was just nice to be able to, you know, stream right off the LTE on the iPhone straight via Bluetooth to the Music Cast device.
So since I'm going to be using the HomePod to listen to music probably more than I have other devices, I wanted to talk to you guys about a piece of software. I've used this since it came out, but it's recently gotten a lot better, and I've noticed the UI is miles better than what it used to be. You'll remember when Apple Music first launched, there were people who were writing utilities to convert you from Spotify to Apple Music and vice versa. And those weren't very good utilities in the beginning. I think in the beginning it was using the old Beats API to access Apple Music, and then that was not perfect and it was deprecated. So now there's an app. It's called SongShift, and it's an iOS only app. It's been out for a long time, but version 3.0 launched probably back in November, October, somewhere in that time frame. And what this does is it uses the Spotify web API and MusicKit on iOS, both of those, to be able to shift playlists between services. And it supports many different services, but the only ones I've ever really cared about have been Spotify and Apple Music. So you can automatically sync playlists from your source to destination as changes are made to the source playlist. So if you go in and you're using the Discover Weekly in Spotify, which is really good for a lot of people, those mixes they make, but you want to be able to listen to them on the HomePod natively, you can go in through your device and just have it sync over whatever it found for you and move it over to Apple Music. The matching is pretty good. It gets most of the things probably 95%+ of the time. Sometimes it'll refuse to bring things in and you go and dig in a little bit and you'll be like, what's the deal? It already exists on Apple Music, but it's not perfect, but it's getting better all the time. And whenever you launch this thing, it'll auto sync your playlist. It'll look for new songs. It'll do it through the background app refresh. And it's really, really cool. The only problem is that auto sync, since it's running on a device, there's no server component. So you can't just automatically watch whatever something adds to a playlist and sync it over, and you can't sync across multiple devices. So if you set it up on both your iPhone and your iPad, you're going to end up with duplicate songs because it's really just looking at what was there and moving it over since the last time it changed. I hope that that gets fixed, but I mean, most people, if you're like most people, you're going to listen to it primarily on one device. So just use it on your phone or your iPad or whatever, and don't use it on both, and you're good. Are you guys familiar with this software?
I use an app called JMusic. It doesn't monitor your playlist, but it's really good at converting Spotify playlist over to Apple Music. So that's what I've used, and I've still used it here recently, and it's really good. There's a huge, I went out looking for this month or so ago. There's a huge playlist on Spotify that is the entire archives of every song that ever appeared on MTV's 120 Minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's over 3,000 songs, and I wanted that list on my Apple Music. And so I tried it, and I think it out of 3,000 songs, it was missing, I don't know, it was like 40 or less. I mean, it was crazy. And, you know, some of those were really old, obscure stuff that it was missing. It doesn't do the live syncing like you're describing, which I think would be pretty sharp. Does this software do deltas where if you remove a song, does it remove it, or does it just keep adding new stuff?
I think it just keeps adding new stuff. I don't normally remove. Like, I'll have it sync stuff over, and I usually don't go take things out. So I'll test that use case. Does JMusic run on iOS? I assume it does because it's using MusicKit.
Yeah, it's just iOS. Yeah, I've mostly run it on my iPad because it's kind of a set it and forget it. Like, you know, if it's a big playlist like that, you just tell it to start, and eventually you go back and you see you have your playlist on iOS. You can turn on notifications, and it'll ding when it's done. So for a short playlist, you know, I can do it on my phone, but for the big ones, I generally just set it on my iPad and set it down somewhere. But that syncing does sound pretty cool, because I have one playlist that it's called the Gems driving playlist. And I know I have a couple of people that subscribe to it on Spotify and a couple of people that subscribe to it on Apple Music. And I try to keep it sort of synced, kind of how I was just describing to you. I don't really remove anything. Like, I do remove stuff from one or the other, but I don't actively try to remove it from the other one. But when I add a song to one, I try to remember to add it to the other. So that would be kind of nice if I had synced those up.
There was one that came out for the Mac right after Apple Music was announced.
That's one you and I used to use.
I think I bought it for, I don't know, it was like $3 or something.
Like $5 or something.
And it sort of worked, but I haven't bothered with another sync service ever since.
It was very primitive.
It wasn't worth the trouble to me.
You would have to go in and do these weird things to make it work. It was very strange. And he made it more polished. I can't remember the name of it, but it was very primitive. And it's not supported anymore. It hasn't been in quite some time. And that was what made me seek out an alternative about a year and a half ago. And that's where I found SongShift. And the UI, I mean, the version 3 that came out in the fall is so much better. And I don't know why I never mentioned it before now, but I guess now that I'm going to be trying to use this one more, we'll see.
Yeah, no, that sounds pretty cool. And I remember that one we used. I tried to use it a lot because I had never been a Spotify user.
I think it was called Move to Apple Music.
I had never been a Spotify user. And so when I moved over there, I already had a lot of playlists on Apple Music. And so I was trying to move those over. But now it's I don't know if it sounds like you have a similar use case, Brian. You're wanting to get all those really good playlists off Spotify and copy them over to your Apple Music.
I don't want to have to use AirPlay to do these things. So, and I've done this for a while too. I mean, I've moved things over, but the playlists that I make are usually pretty static. You know, once I have them converted between the two, it's fine. But definitely take a look at that. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's a great piece of software. I think it's like $5 or something. It's not very expensive, and it serves a real useful purpose. So one of the things that was announced this week is that Apple is delaying big new iOS features to focus on stability in 2018. And I think everybody is going to be happy about that. What do you guys think?
I think it means they don't have enough engineers to do the new software that they're going to do, like the upgrades. And so they just say, hey, we're going to fix all this stuff, when actually we're not really getting anything with iOS 12. It's just going to be like almost nothing.
Well, hopefully they're fixing Siri on HomePod, Siri on Apple Watch, Siri on macOS. There's lots of room for improvement in Apple software right now. I think most people would, you know, even us longtime Apple folks would agree that the software is not commensurate with the hardware these days.
Well, that's true. Also, a company with over $200 billion in the bank not having enough engineers is probably not a true statement. But it's also
I'm joking.
The old mythical man month thing, right? The more software developers you throw at something, it doesn't make it any better. A woman can make a baby in 9 months. 9 women can't make a baby in 1 month. So I'm really excited about it. I'm glad that they're doing it, because if you think about it, we've talked about it many times on the show, is that you'll see WWDC roll around and you'll have all of these new features that get announced. And a lot of those features don't ship until 6 months after the software is released. Case in point with iOS 11. We still don't have iMessages in the cloud, even though it's about to be here. It took several months for Apple Pay to ship. Last year, it took us a long time to get portrait mode on the iPhone 7. These things, you know, they're doing these sort of cyclic releases anyway, where they'll announce something and then it takes almost the course of the entire release cycle to even get the features out, let alone bug and stability fixes.
That's one of the things I've never understood. I get 5 to 10 app updates every day for all kinds of stuff. You know, most of them are just, you know, they always just say bug fixes, you know, and Facebook famously is like, we're making our app better. We release a new version every 2 weeks, blah, blah, blah.
Which is such a lie, but anyway.
So why can't they fix or add new features to built-in apps besides once a year? I mean, why can't they add something to the email app in January instead of waiting till July to give me different colored message flags? I don't know. I mean, I'm just making something up here, but it's just, I don't even use the mail app anymore because I use Spark, and Spark gets updated, you know, once a month with some nice new features and all kinds of cool stuff. I don't understand why the built-in apps are so tied to the operating system. I mean, Photos is a great example. That's better than email. Google Photos is lapping the built-in Photos app and Photos on the Mac with all the things it can do and the way it works, because it's constantly iterated over, whereas the Photos app is like once a year we get an upgrade where all the new features don't even work right to begin with, and then 3-4 months later, okay, we got it all working, and I just think it's ridiculous.
Yeah, the monolithic nature of iOS doesn't make any sense, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because the changes that are going to be delayed are a home screen refresh, changes to the in-car user interface, which really it could use some refinements, and core apps such as Mail, the camera, photo editing, and sharing are some of the things that are delayed. And that's all things that we really want to see. But ARKit, digital health, and parental controls are still going to get updated in iOS 12. It is funny that you say it. It's a great point. We brought this up forever. You should be able to update individual apps. Things like Maps is the best example to me, where something like, you know, now I think in iOS 11, it will actually show how fast you're traveling inside of the Maps app, the native Maps app, whereas Waze and Google Maps have had that forever. It shouldn't be something where it's mostly a server-side component. The Maps app, when it's displaying things, is getting that data from a back end. Why can the back end not be upgraded at any point? It's nonsensical. I don't understand. I am glad that they're trying to make stability updates, but it doesn't make any sense that they're just not constantly iterating with this.
I would like to know where this sourced from. Where did this come down from, that our stuff is so buggy and we're making too many big mistakes that are hitting the press that we need to backtrack and fix what we got? I mean, is this something that came all the way down from Tim, or, you know, was it a couple layers below him where they decided, hey, we needed to do this, and then they had to like plead their case up top to, you know, to push back these feature updates? I mean, it would be really interesting to me in what part of the organization this update sourced from.
Well, OS updates inherently are complicated, big projects, especially when you have an OS that's used by so many millions of people. Getting an entirely new release of an OS every 12 months at a certain point is just not sustainable. When the iPhone was simpler and you're moving from iOS 2 to iOS 3, iOS 4, oh, we got copy and paste now. Great. You know, those types of changes were easy to implement. But I don't think it's realistic to actually go and release an entirely new version of the operating system every single year. I mean, you can't do it.
I don't know if any hardcore Apple people who actually want that. I mean, I don't think anybody was clamoring for, oh, we got to have new entire OS every year. I think they need to shift some priorities, you know, kind of double down on the software this year.
Just fix the apps. You don't have to replace the operating system every year. If you want to replace the core operating system, wait every 2-3 years for that. But fix and add features to the apps over time. I mean, it's just, I hate to bring it up, but, you know, Windows runs on hardware from all over the world, all kind of different pieces of crap. You can put together a computer and run Windows on it. Apple controls all their hardware. So, not that OSs are easy, but at least OSs are easy when it only runs on your hardware.
Conceptually, it should be easier when it only runs on your hardware.
It seems ridiculous.
No, I agree with you to some extent, but the difference is what we expect out of operating systems has evolved greatly compared to anything that we had in the past. The difference between, you know, macOS 10.5 to 10.6, since we're going to invoke Snow Leopard in just a moment, those weren't huge, huge changes. But when they're doing things like moving from HFS Plus to writing a file system that runs on everything from a watch to an iMac Pro, for example, that's a big deal. When you're having to do something with Siri, which that is so core to the operating system that I could see you're going to have to upgrade the entire operating system to be able to handle that. I kind of get it. But things like you're pointing out, like Maps, Mail, the home screen, CarPlay, things like that should be a little bit... Photos, oh my goodness, should be a little bit more... It should be something that you could do during the course of the year. I don't understand. You know, this year, whenever we see Gruber get those people on stage after WWDC, like Schiller and Q and all those folks, I would love to see a hard-hitting question like, why can't we just get apps updated throughout the course of the year instead of having to wait for an OS update? That's ridiculous. That being said, I would be happy with a Snow Leopard version of iOS where it's just sort of a rebuilding year, let's say, where it's focusing on stability and whatever else.
Yeah, old Gruber throws them softballs.
I mean, I get it. He wants them to come back, but, you know, be as hard-hitting on them as you would the president, let's say. Let's find out. Let's get some questions answered that we want to know.
Want him to punch Phil Schiller in the face?
No, but, you know, again, there is a perception, and it's not an unfair perception, that things like Photos and Maps and things that, those are good examples of apps. I wouldn't say Mail so much, but Photos and Maps are a great example of something where it's laughed at, and alternatives are so much more popular. That should really worry them. That should irritate them to want to do better. And why they have to wait every single year. When you're only releasing one version of a piece of software every year, can you imagine? Nobody else in the industry does that at all. It's nuts. And it's so core to the experience.
Like I said, I mean, they've enabled it. I mean, I get 5 to 10 app updates every day, just simple stuff. You know, we fixed this. We had this nagging little bug, or, you know, we had 6 bugs that people reported, and over the last couple of weeks, we fixed them. And so here's a new version for those 10 people who had these 6 bugs. I mean, it's that kind of thing. And if there's just so many nagging little bugs right now in macOS and iOS. I mean, if you go, you know, start searching for stuff, you know, this didn't sync. I think last week's episode, we were talking about all kind of, you know, I was talking about my contacts not syncing between the devices. And I think you mentioned something else not working right between devices. It's just, it's kind of, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll lead us in here, but, you know, this is, you know, we're finally getting our Snow Leopard for iOS, right?
My major complaint about the whole iOS updates was the mail app, because there's no consistency in it between like my wife's iPad and her iPhone. I mean, things that work on one don't work on the other, and she doesn't seem to have issues with other apps, you know, other Apple apps. And then so I've put her on Spark for her email, and she hasn't looked back.
How about handoff, like Jim has talked about before, between Apple Music from device to device? Implement that. You already have handoff. Make it work for this one app.
I mean, we haven't even said Spotify, but Spotify is blowing by Apple Music with all kind of features that they can put in all the time, and they're available on every different device in the world. I mean, I'm surprised they don't sell toasters that, you know, will stream Spotify to it now. I mean, it's crazy.
Though with the royalties from songwriters doubling, that was just announced. We didn't talk about that, but songwriters now, their royalties have doubled, which is going to impact the price of streaming music. So anybody that's not doing something other than streaming music, like, I don't know, selling hardware or maybe running a search engine or something like that, you're gonna see some tough decisions that have to get made.
Hint, 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 hint.
But that's neither here nor there. But no, this is, as much as we liked Snow Leopard, and there's an article out there, you know, about the myth of Snow Leopard, that's, we're not going to go too much into it, but we'll link to it. That was on 9to5 Mac. It's very good for those who haven't been in the ecosystem maybe that long. Maybe you're introduced to the ecosystem through iOS and you weren't running the Mac way back in 2009. It's a good read, because that's basically what we're trying to look at for iOS. I think there's a perception too, at least there will be from the Android camp, of, you know, oh, we're going to fall behind. But you look at so many devices that can't even upgrade to whatever the latest version of Android is, that probably won't be an issue. The adoption is always greater on iOS devices than it is on Android for latest versions. So I don't think that's going to be a you're falling behind type of moment.
I think my first Mac had Leopard on it. I think that's what my first one had, was Leopard, and then I, you know, went to Snow Leopard. Because it would have been about, I guess, 2006, 7, 8, somewhere in that range. Because I know in 05, when Katrina hit, I still had my ThinkPad, which was probably one of my favorite laptops I've ever owned in my whole life.
Leopard was my first foray. Got a 2008 17-inch MacBook Pro, and then the 2009 Mac Pro both came with Leopard. I was telling Brian before the show that I had kind of come across my old receipt for Snow Leopard when you actually had to buy the OS. Purchased Snow Leopard I purchased it August 18th, 2009.
Buy like a family pack.
For the whopping price of $43.99 for a five-person, which was actually not a five-person, it was a five-machine family pack.
Yeah, my first version of macOS was Snow Leopard, and I put it on a Hackintosh Dell netbook that I bought in 2009. That's what actually got me, you know, I liked it enough that I was ready to take the plunge by buying an iMac after that. And that was because you could still buy it, right? You can't go and buy macOS now in a store. You have to have it with a Mac, and it's only delivered through the App Store. So that was about the last time that I could go and get a physical copy that I could use to put on a Hackintosh way back when. So that was definitely my first introduction.
If I looked hard enough, I bet I could find a Snow Leopard disc around here somewhere. It's in the bottom of some box or something. I might have thrown it away, but
I think I threw mine out because it's like, I'm never going to be able to run this again. So who cares? Chuck it.
Yeah, I'm positive I still have one of mine.
So here's the discussion. So we quickly brought up Spotify and the music rights prices going up. Does it make sense for Netflix to buy Spotify? Netflix is making all original content now, and they're charging their price. Spotify is doing the thing that Netflix was doing that they realized they maybe couldn't make, you know, as much money on. So, I mean, does it make sense to for somebody like, I mean, who could, from a different angle, not should Netflix buy Spotify, who could buy Spotify and actually keep them intact and as good as they are now and still be able to make money off that type of service?
Everybody with the pockets deep enough to do it are already competing with it. So Amazon, Google, and Apple are all, they all have their own services. So unless it was to just eliminate the competition. I don't see anyone that would go and do it. And if you don't, you really don't, that's a terrible reason to do it, because if the prices keep raising up and they can't, and they have to raise prices, but their competitors don't, they'll eventually go out of business anyway or be bought for pennies on the dollar. So there's no, until they become a, they pivot and do what Netflix is doing and becoming a content producer, become an actual label, you're not going to see anything happen. And you know, this is an interesting point, because we've talked before, why is it that we see Apple putting, like, you know, original content in the music app? And I've really struggled with that. There's a couple of things that I realized, though, is that the Apple Music app is available on Android across the board. Like, you don't have iTunes on Android. You don't have the TV app on Android. You have the Apple Music app on multiple platforms. So having that, and since mobile is probably more important than the desktop, I think that's why they've been bundling that in there. A bigger question might be, should somebody like Spotify start producing video content to go along with that? Like, I had heard you can get your podcast listed on Spotify, allegedly. We haven't been able to do it, but that's also an area that they should have moved into. Audiobooks, like anything that has audio content at all, they should be a part in.
Podcasts would have been great. They could totally add a podcast, like a nice podcast player, into Spotify and do real well with that, I would think.
There are podcasts in Spotify, as I mentioned, but not...
Yeah, they're there, but yeah, it's not a full-blown, like, let me search for anything that's on the iTunes store type podcast player.
Exactly. Like, if you look at this show, we're on Google Play, we're on iTunes, we're on Overcast, Pocket Cast. Like, we have the URLs listed. You can find us in any number of directories. How great would it be to be in a directory that has, like, you know, 100 million users? I would absolutely love to have it in there, but it's an arcane process. You have to ask, and if they decide to let you in, they'll let you in. If people want to give you content for free that you can then turn around and monetize, and you don't do it, you're insane. That's just... Now, I wouldn't want to see them become something like Stitcher, which Stitcher would take people's podcasts without asking and monetize them and compress them and do all sorts of nasty things before they got bought. So I don't like that model necessarily, but if somebody wants to submit it, like you submit your podcast to iTunes, why would you not do it? It's silly to me. I worry about their long-term prospects is what I'm saying.
It seems like the people who are in Spotify podcast directory are part of an already large network, like,
yes,
Parcast. Or what I don't like about trying to play, because I've played a few podcasts in Spotify, it doesn't really have the ability to queue up several podcasts in a row, so I can just sit there and drive. Say I need to drive for an hour and I'm going to listen to 4 15-minute podcasts. I can't queue them all up in a row. That's annoying. So I tried it maybe once or twice and then just went right back to my default Pocket Cast app.
Yeah, it definitely needs some improvement. I don't know.
Sorry for that rabbit hole. It got me thinking, you know, what are the possibilities here? Because I think we all really like Spotify. I mean, I was a total Apple Music homer. I loved it. And you guys were, I think early in the podcast, we had the 1% Music Club that we talked about. And, you know, Brian, you were doing both. And Brad, you were doing both. And I'm like, no, Apple Music, rah, 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 you know. And then once I started using Spotify, I realized the great things that it does, especially in content
curation,
that's the word, sorry, curation. And so now I think, Brad, I think you said you dropped your Apple Music subscription, right? You're just Spotify household now?
After I got Apple Watch, I started back up Apple Music for an individual just so I could try out the Apple Music streaming to my watch, which I haven't used very much.
Yeah, but it is kind of cool, you got to admit.
It is cool.
So, okay. And then, Brian, you're still doing both and...
Yeah, I need to do the year subscription for both, so I end up paying less. I haven't done it. I do like that when you put an iTunes card on your account, if it's of a certain amount, Apple will go, hey, would you like to go ahead and just pay for all of your Apple Music for an entire year?
That was awesome. That's how I did mine, too. Jason, are you a both or a one or the other? Since you're a Sonos household, I would think that you have used Spotify, right?
Nope. I only use Apple Music these days.
Wow.
Hardcore.
Is there a one-year family plan that you can purchase on Apple Music? Because I've never seen it.
I don't have a family, so I don't know.
I was looking to Brad on that one because he would be the most likely to do that.
I only saw through you could do an individual for a year, but I'm not sure if you could do a family for a year. You know, and if you do the individual for a year, you save $20 a year, because I mean, what is it, $9.99 a month for 12 months versus $99 for a year?
I've almost changed my Spotify over to a family plan just so I could stream in multiple places if I wanted, just so I, you know, I could stream it at home and then, you know, stream in the car or, you know.
Have you figured out a way to clone yourself? Have you got some sort of quantum technology that puts you in two places at once? What's happening?
It seems like everybody I know that's on Spotify is on some sort of family plan that they're sharing with a friend, and here's me paying $10 a month all by myself. I'm like, I got to find a girl so I can share my Spotify. That's basically the only reason I need to find a girlfriend now.
But then what do you do when you break up? You're like, you're cut off. No more Spotify for you.
That gets really ugly when you have to take away the Netflix, because I've had to do that before, and it's pretty ugly when you have to go in and you have to log out all the devices and change your password. And then, you know, you get that nasty text message. It goes, oh, you had to take away the Netflix.
I was in the middle of Breaking Bad. What am I going to do now?
So Apple's earnings were announced this week for the quarter, and they sold 77.3 million iPhones over the holidays. However, they were projected to have sold 80 million by analyst estimates, so they missed projections. But still, that is a really good quarter.
That's insane. I was going to say I'm no math expert, but I'm pretty good at math. 77 million iPhones in one quarter. So a quarter is roughly about 90 days. So that's almost a million iPhones a day. 0.75, 0.8, you know, somewhere in that range. Per day, million iPhones a day. Insane.
That's just short of the record of 78.2 million units in Q1 of 2017. So that's still mighty impressive. That's still almost an all-time high. The coolest thing about this that came out is that Apple now has 1.3 billion active devices worldwide. Think about that. That's amazing adoption for something.
Well, so to play Debbie Downer just a little bit on these numbers, I did look it up. The iPhone 7 and 7 Plus were released September 16th of last year. So that gave them 14 days worth of sales in the second quarter. And there was no third coming later device like the iPhone 10. Whereas this year, the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus were released on September 22nd. So that gave 8 days worth of sales for Q2, meaning that everything beyond September 30th was iPhone 10, iPhone 8, 8 Plus. So that may be one of the reasons why the numbers are a little bit better here in Q4, is because, you know, there was only a 8-day cycle in Q3 and the demand was not nearly as high on the 8 or 8 Plus, knowing that the 10 was right around the corner.
Yeah, and it's the first time in 6 years that they've ever had that, the first time in 6 years that's happened, where they've had an entire iPhone release cycle to be part of a quarter, which, you know, again, doesn't happen very often. I guess 2011, that was the year that the 4S came out, and that came out in October of 2011. So that was a late shipping iPhone, relatively. So that was the reason for that. So good catch on that one. Yes, that wasn't even in the show notes.
Yeah, that's a pretty astute tritechery type analysis there, Jason.
Thank you very much, sir.
Lots of good nuggets released in these notes. Apple apparently did not consider how the battery replacements program would impact iPhone upgrade rates. I think that's a pretty smart move. It's nice and customer friendly, but realistically, I don't think it's going to impact the numbers. People want the new iPhone when it comes out, regardless of what they've done to the batteries, and I don't think it's going to end up being a big deal.
There's plenty of people that couldn't name what's going on in the news, much less that Apple's going to replace their battery. They just don't know it exists. My thinking is the segment that's going to benefit from this is the hand-me-down phone, where those people weren't going to buy new phones anyway. They're replacing that battery and that phone is going down. So I don't think them replacing the battery is necessarily going to keep them from selling a new phone, is my point. I kind of got backwards there.
I have anecdotal evidence that backs up exactly what you're saying. My sister-in-law is getting in on the Apple upgrade, the battery upgrade program, and she's going to take that and give that to one of her kids, and she's going to go out and buy a new iPhone to replace the one that she's using as the hand-me-down is going to a kid. She's getting a new iPhone. So again, I don't think this is going to be as bad as analysts are predicting. I don't think it's going to be like the 16 million units is going to be impacted type of thing.
So it's almost like the battery program is allowing them to sell an extra phone, because maybe she wouldn't have upgraded hers, but hey, I can put a new battery in this old one, give it to my kid, and I get a new one.
Yep.
So there's it's actually selling a phone, not the opposite.
Exactly. So revenue from the iPhone 8 and the 10 lines were the highest in the company's history of previous iPhone releases. We've seen a lot of notes in the news lately from who's that analyst who's looking at the supply chain, who's always poo-pooing on it?
Ming-Chi Kuo is the KGI securities analyst who's always got his sources within Apple supply chain.
And we know that you can't really look at the supply chain. It's the iPhone X has been the top-selling phone every week since it came out. I don't know if you can always pay attention to that, but apparently the numbers have been very well. If you sell nearly as many as you did in a record quarter, it would hardly seem like it's a failure between the 8 and the 10. So that's
surprising that the iPad numbers were slightly up, right? Do I remember that correctly? iPad numbers slightly right? That surprises me because I love my iPad, and I know there are people that love their iPads, but iPads to me, for not us because we're you know way out there, iPads last forever. Like, my stepdad, he spends more time on his iPad than anything, than his phone, than his computer, and anything. But he's still running, like, an Air 3 or whatever it was called. And I've even talked to him, and he's really got no reason to upgrade. I mean, you know, it's crazy. iPads last forever.
The iPad numbers were kind of flat. They weren't great. But the overall market share for the iPad in terms of tablets went up to 46% of the U.S. tablet market, up from 36%. So it did go up, but not it wasn't a phenomenal rate. But yeah, you're right. In general, people do hang on to them forever. My parents use their iPads more than anything else. My wife uses her iPad more than anything else. But I think, too...
And maybe people are finally realizing that all those Android tablets are crap. And so maybe you're not selling near as many of those cheapo Android tablets that would drive up the market share for those. And so that's one of the reasons that the Apple market share is up is because they're not just selling those, you know, $99, 7, 9, 10 inch pieces of crap, you know. And so people are going to iPad now. And
particularly with the Pros, which are a credible enough desktop replacement for light use, that I don't think that that's really a stretch. Again, the example that I used was, you know, having the Pro earlier this year where I'm on a plane and I have it on the seat back in front of me and I'm editing PowerPoints in Doc and I'm surfing the web in Safari in a split screen. These are things that I couldn't do prior to iOS 11. So it got the job done. The battery lasts a ridiculously long time. It was built for mobile, whereas, you know, macOS really wasn't. So I think for a lot of people, they're starting to see the benefit. I would much rather have an iPad Pro than a MacBook Pro right now, particularly with the quality issues that you guys have had. So it totally makes sense to me. Whereas you wouldn't be saying that about a Fire tablet, a Fire HD or whatever. If all you're doing is watching movies, and that's great. But if you actually want to do some work on it, you really can't.
I love my iPad Pro, the 9.7 inch version. And before the iPhone X came out, I was on that iPad a lot more than my 7 Plus. Since the 10 came out, I'm not on it quite as much because you've got the bigger screen on the 10 and I, you know, it's fast and new and all that stuff. So I've definitely found myself not on the iPad as much as I was. But before the 10, the iPad was around the house was my primary device. I mean, I would set my phone down and keep the iPad near me before the iPhone 10. And that, so now it's, you know, a little bit less, just depends on what I'm doing. Plus, I'm getting old and I can't see. So that nice big iPad screen, I hate to admit that, but
amen,
it's
brother.
So nice.
I hate to admit it too, but yes, I've seen that as well. The Apple Watch also had a really good quarter, so it's seen its best quarter ever with sales up more than 100% compared to the Series 2 from the previous year, and it's seen 50% growth in unit sales and revenue for the fourth consecutive quarter. The thing that troubles me more than anything is that you see these numbers where the sales of the Apple Watch keep going up and up and up, but I see so many companies dropping their Apple Watch apps. So Google dropped their Maps app for the Apple Watch, Twitter dropped theirs earlier this year, just the other day, Slack dropped theirs. Granted, none of these were great implementations on the Apple Watch, but I really wish they would stop doing that because I think at some point you're going to be able to make something that actually can use that interface. And I want to see more apps for this. I can set and disarm my alarm for my Apple Watch. I can pay for my coffee or my boarding pass like we were talking about. I can do all these things. I want to be able to do things with more of these apps. Please, folks, figure out a way to make apps that don't suck and stop discontinuing.
See, I disagree with you. I don't think the Apple Watch needs that many apps. I don't use that many apps on my Apple Watch. I like the weather. I love being able to have the weather on there. You know, it tells time. I get a... Yeah, exactly.
Imagine that, a watch.
Yeah.
The killer app, the time.
You know, I get my notifications on there. It's for me, it's kind of an extension of the phone as far as, you know, the notifications and that kind of stuff. I'd start up Pokemon on there. I keep track of my workouts on there. But as far as other apps, I don't see the benefit of having Slack on my watch. I'm not going to read a Slack. If I get a notification, that's fine. But then I'm going to go look at my phone to read the Slack. I don't understand why Slack needs an Apple Watch app.
Let me ask you this. Do you use the Siri functionality on your watch at all? Do you read messages and reply using Siri functionality on your watch?
Almost never.
You're not the use case that I am then. So I'll get stuff on my watch all the time, and I will dictate a message to reply to say, you know, I get a note, you know, when are you coming home, or what are you doing this, or what are you doing that? And I'll fire it up and I'll hit the button and I'll speak to it and then go about my business and do what I'm doing. I'll take phone calls.
I do that too.
Exactly. It's a super useful, honestly, if you're not using it for that functionality, you're really not getting the most out of it, because being able to, you know, I'll get replies, and if I want to send an emoji, I can just tap one off on the wrist without having to pull out the phone. So it's phenomenal.
It's 10:39. That's what I do with my Apple Watch. No, I'm kidding.
No, but it's capable of doing so much more. And I think this ties in well with the HomePod. I want to see Siri integration with a lot of these things. You know, turning my stuff on and off, my devices on and off, opening my garage door. Like, I use Siri a great bit on my watch.
Okay, you got me there. I do use that. I use Siri on my watch for devices, because I'll be walking around the house and I won't know where my phone is or where my iPad is, and it's easier to just raise my wrist and say, turn on the light.
I've taken my phone calls on there
totally.
Like that, because I don't know where my
phone
is.
I've done that a couple of times, you know, just I'm walking, I've got my backpack, I'm in the airport, or somehow, you know, whatever. I don't have my AirPods handy. You know, I'll answer the phone on my watch. I've done that a couple of times, but not very many. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a use case. It's more of a edge case for me. So I think we've talked about this many times on the podcast. I'm not as much of a Siri user. I like, you know, touching things.
Even though you'll talk to your Echo all day long.
Yeah, me and her, we're tight.
we're kicking you off the show. We're gonna spin off an Amazon only podcast, and that's gonna be Jim.
So you're gonna have to mute down the word Echo, because that's one of the names that I use for one of my devices that's also close to another Echo Dot.
Most people don't change the defaults though, Jason.
So did you see the news this week that there's actually something built into the software on the Amazon devices to where it won't go off today when they have commercials during? So today is Super Bowl Sunday.
Yes.
We're recording. And so there was that big story online about how they're going to have commercials where they talk about Amazon devices and they use the keyword, but somehow it's like they've done some trickeration where it sends out an inaudible chirp to let the Amazon device know to not answer, and then it'll say the keyword, which I'm not going to say, and it won't go off. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I saw that article, and you remember last year Burger King did the same thing with Google to invoke that device and say, tell me about Burger King, and it would read off the Wikipedia entry to Burger King. You know, they could solve a lot of these problems if they would put voice recognition in these things so only the people that are trained on it could do it. That would be, I'm honestly surprised that hasn't happened yet. You know, kind of like Apple does on your devices. If I invoke my assistant, it doesn't make, and my wife's iPhone and iPad are close by, it doesn't invoke it on her device. It only invokes it on my device because it's trained to my voice. They all ought to do that. Also, they ought to change the stupid keyword to be a two-word thing like Google and Apple use instead of a single one. That's ridiculous.
Well, and I'll give Amazon a little do here. It's a home device, not like like your iPhone is your personal device, your iPad, your watch is your personal device. I'm the only one that lives here, but you know, Brad at any one time could have him and his wife and two kids in and out of the house, and if they want to holler at the device, it just needs to identify the keyword. And so that's the thing with the Amazon device, is that one is four people and one word, so it just goes off all the time.
Identifying multiple users, though, and having context is important. If you have multiple users and you want to hear your calendar or your text messages or something like that, being able to identify multiple users would be a great thing. If all the processing power is in the cloud, then know that voice and respond accordingly to that data. That's absolutely an important thing. That's even more reason it should support multiple users, but not support everybody in the world that comes in because of the shenanigans that get pulled. There was a news story last year where somebody invoked the Echo to order something on a newscast or something, and people were complaining, oh, I got, you know, paper towels sent to me, or a dollhouse or something stupid, because that happened. All the more reason to just make it so that it knows your voice. It needs to be personalized.
My daughter's favorite thing, and it's still funny to her, is to Rickroll us. So I'll be playing some music or a podcast while I'm cooking or cleaning the kitchen, and she just walks in and says, hey, play that song. And it, of course, stops what I'm doing to, you know, make me have to shift back. And it never gets, it's never not funny to her. It's funny every time.
So when they're commercial, is it the Amazon device that can recognize different voices? Because when they said, play like my something another playlist, and it recognizes different people's voice to play different name, different playlist. Was that Amazon? Was that the Amazon commercial? I forget.
I have not seen it, and I don't have multiple users that use mine either. So we'll look it up for. So we're coming up on the end of the show. We have a couple of last things that I want to get to just before we go. So it looks like iOS 11.3 is hinting that that Apple will be doing a new component called Secure Channel that will let you use your iCloud credentials to sign in on websites, kind of like Facebook and Google do today. That's kind of exciting to me. Given the emphasis that Apple has on privacy, I'm less concerned that that would be misused somewhere. So I'm kind of hopeful about that. And if so, letting my face identify through that would be an awesome thing to do. But we'll see when iOS 11.3 comes out. Do you guys think he would use that at all?
Sure. I would, you know, if I'm going to trust anybody with that stuff, it's Apple.
Same here. I avoid trying to use like the Facebook login just because I know it's going to hook something in and send more ads to my Facebook feed.
Exactly. And again, if you ever want to quit it, it's a hard thing to, you know, I think to use the Spotify example, sometimes you have to use, I think there for a while they were requiring after a certain date, you had to use Facebook or something, right? Wasn't that the... Somebody I know that joined.
I think they tried to, and then they kind of had to backtrack on that.
They backed off. Good deal. Good deal.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Like, you know, I always, like, once a week, I have this, I'm going to quit Facebook, like, moment. And, you know, I never do. But if I quit it, I mean, there's, I like Brad, try not to use it for certain things. But for some things, it's just easier just to, you know, like, what's the name of that game that I play? The Trivia Crack. You know, I just use my Facebook login because it's easy and it's easier to find players, you know, friends to play with and that kind of thing. You know, so, I mean, that's a real good example.
Yeah, I know what you mean. That's, again, I want somebody that I can trust when it comes to that data. So I would definitely use that. And plus, since I pay for my iCloud access, I don't think I'm ever going to move away from that. I have too much that's in it already. And given Apple's focus on privacy, that's kind of a cool thing. I do hope that that happens. And it's not something I remember them mentioning at WWDC. So hopefully that'll get fixed. The last thing I want to cover before we go is Nintendo announced this week that Mario Kart will be playable on iPhones by March of 2019. And this may be the happiest news that I've read all year.
That's like a month. That could be a huge launch for iOS, right?
No, that's March 2019.
A year and a month.
Oh, a year and a month. Okay. I saw it, all the articles I saw just said March. They never had a date behind it. So I'm thinking next month. Ugh.
I can tell you the most played game that I've had on the Switch has been Mario Kart. And I haven't used my Switch as a portable yet. I've used it solely as a console. And me and my wife will just sit there and play it on the 65-inch TV. And it is fantastic, especially since they redid it for HD.
And it never gets old. It's such a fun game. And it has been since college.
Yes, it never gets old, even though you've played those boards a million times.
I agree. Yeah. That,
if you put it on my phone, I'll have less reason to carry a Switch around eventually. So that would be a good thing. I guess. I don't know. I still like Super Mario Run on the iPhone, though I play that on the iPad more than I play it on the iPhone, just because that bigger display makes it...
Yeah, the bigger display is better for Mario.
Yeah. Well, I think that is all that we had for this week, and what a busy week it was. That's uncharacteristic to have this much Apple news drop in late January, early February. So, good stuff. And next week, we should have our HomePods by the time we record, so we'll have tried those out and given you some first impressions of that, so that'll be fun.
On next week's episode, the Dinks get their HomePods.
Ah, well. All right, fellas. Well, signing off, and that should do it for this week. And later, fellas.
Later, fellas.
Later, fellas.
Later, fellas.
Please visit infiniteloopback.com for show notes and previous episodes. Follow us on Twitter. We're at infinloopback. That's at I-N-F-I-N loopback. I'm Brian B. That's at B-R-I-A-N-B. Jim is at Big Jim, that's at B-I-G-J-I-M. Jason is at J-S-N-Y-N-G, that's at J-S-N-Y-N-G. And Brad is at Meester Idle, that's at M-E-E-S-T-E-R-I-D-L-E. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.